East of the Pacific, making histories of Asian American art. On view now through August 16th at the Columbus Museum of Art. Featuring more than 60 works of artists of Asian descent, the exhibition explores how migration across the Pacific has shaped American art and culture. Experience the stories, perspectives, and artistic contributions that continue to influence our world. Don't miss East of the Pacific, making histories of Asian American art, now through August 16th. Plan your visit today at columbusmuseum.org.
Hello and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Crime with Holly. It's your girl, Holly, and if you couldn't tell from the title of today's episode, we do have a guest host filling in for me this week. Her name is Kylie. I have previously shared one of her episodes on the podcast. Life has been just very busy this past week, and I spent all day roasting in the sun on Saturday because my son had a football camp, an all-day camp that he went to where he got to showcase his football skills, and so I was unable to record. Kylie has been busy with her life, so we decided to just go ahead and do an episode swap this week so that our listeners could listen to someone new, maybe find a new podcast that they enjoy. Kylie is one of my online true crime podcast friends that I have met through a wonderful community of women in podcasting. I am so excited to say that I will be meeting Kylie at CrimeCon, and I hope to be meeting all of you guys at CrimeCon as well. I will just be attending CrimeCon as a spectator. However, I have been invited to spend some of Saturday with Heather Ashley from Big Mad True Crime. So if you are wanting to find me at CrimeCon, get some swag because I will have some swag to give out. Find me. I will be wearing different true crime shirts, but you will for sure be able to find me at Heather Ashley's Big Mad True Crime table on Saturday. So make sure if you see me wandering around CrimeCon, you stop me, you say hello, make sure you get some of my swag that I have that I'm going to be giving away, and let's take a picture. I want to meet you guys. I'm so excited. I've never been to CrimeCon, so this is going to be super exciting. I get to meet Angeline Hartman officially in person and give her a big hug, and so many other amazing people within the true crime community and creators. Anywho, I will pass the mic over to Kylie. She is a wonderful person. Check the description of this episode to find her social medias and make sure you follow her wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you again, Kylie, for filling in for me. I appreciate you so much. You helped me out big time. All right, guys, I will see you next week.
Warning, this episode contains graphic crime scene detail. Please listen with discretion. Welcome to Primetime Crime. I'm your host, Kylie. Let's talk right now in true crime. And then together we are going to work on warming up some cold cases. Let's go.
Alrighty, guys. Today we are jumping in to a brand new unsolved case. On this week's episode, I'm going to be telling you about the 1972 homicide of a 16-year-old girl named Jeanette DePalma out of Union, New Jersey. Her murder remains unsolved, and there has been a lot of talk and speculation surrounding her death over the years. This story was featured on Weird New Jersey, as well as covered in a book called Death on the Devil's Teeth. There are a lot of rumors that suggested that Jeanette's death was related to an occult sacrifice. So we are going to break it all down. We're going to talk about everything and talk about where the case stands today. For my research, I will link all the articles below. And I also watched a show on Hulu called Out There, Crimes of the Paranormal. This particular episode was season 1, episode 4. And like I said, you can find that on Hulu. I am going to link it below as well. They interview many family members and people from law enforcement, so you really get a full picture of Jeanette's story. As always, we are going to talk a little bit about Jeanette and who she was so we can get to the part where we're talking about her unfortunate death. Jeanette Christine De Palma was born on August 3rd of 1956 in Jersey City, New Jersey, to her parents, Salvatore and Florence De Palma. The couple already had several children by the time Jeanette was born, and they would add their last daughter and child just a year later. The family was a very large Catholic Italian family. They had five daughters and three sons. In the mid-1960s, the family ended up moving from Roselle, New Jersey, to the township of Springfield, New Jersey. And those two locations were about 30 minutes apart from each other. Springfield had a very good reputation, and from what the De Palma family knew, they thought that this would be a great place for them to raise their family. They moved into a beautiful home that was five bedrooms, four bathrooms at 4 Clearview Road, and they bought the house for $65,000. Can you even imagine buying a house that big in New Jersey for $65,000? The De Palma family was pretty low-key, and they really didn't socialize too much with those that were around them. Jeanette was described as somebody who was just a normal teenager. She was quiet, funny, sweet, and a very good friend. She loved rock music, and she enjoyed hanging out with her friends, and every so often, she would attend different parties. Typical teenage behavior. Oftentimes, to get around town, Jeanette would hitchhike, which was very common back in those days, and a common mode of transportation for a lot of young teens and adults alike. Jeanette attended Jonathan Dayton Regional and was a junior at the time of her death, and she had been making plans to attend Trinity Bible Institute in North Dakota after she graduated the following year. Unfortunately, she never got that chance. Once the De Palma family moved to Springfield, New Jersey, they started to attend the Assemblies of God Evangel Church in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And they kind of took this to the extreme and would attend this church multiple times a week. And they would also go on to label themselves as born-again evangelical Christians. And those that surrounded the De Palma family thought that this was interesting because they did come from such a strict Italian Catholic family. And they had kind of taken this new level of Christianity to the extreme. There were even some people that speculated that the De Palma family were part of the mafia. And there were people that said that the members of the De Palma family were rude and just weird in general. But honestly, my personal opinion is that the De Palmas were new to town. They weren't going out of their way to be social with people. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of different religious groups and people can be very judgmental. And I think that's probably what was going on here. The De Palmas probably just weren't super social people. And besides doing their church activities and everything, I think they just basically kept to themselves, and people that surrounded them in their neighborhood just thought for whatever reason that they were not very nice. But it doesn't sound like the people that they went to church with felt this way. So I think it was very much just them trying to mind their own and probably not being super social with those that were outside of their circle. And I personally don't think there's anything wrong with that. And it does sound like they did have a pretty good community within this church. There was even a point in time where Jeanette dated the pastor of the church's son. And although they did date, he said they never really saw each other outside of church because they did live in different towns. So they eventually decided to part ways. And this was about a month before Jeanette went missing. This was also at a time in our country where a lot of people were turning from drugs to religion, and they were very much involved in the religion of it all and taking it to the extreme. So again, the De Palmas moving from Roselle to Springfield, turning on this new religious leaf, I'm sure there were a lot of people that judged and speculated, and being the new people in town, people also didn't really know them. One of Jeanette's nephews is quoted as saying that they were very much looked upon as second-class citizens once they moved to Springfield. So I think the consensus is that the De Palma family wasn't very well known in Springfield, but they also had a lot of speculation and rumors surrounding them. And because they didn't go out of their way to be overly friendly to those that surrounded them, they were just kind of like the black sheep, which is unfortunate. Given where our story goes, it is very unfortunate. Because I think that has fueled a lot of the rumor and speculation surrounding Jeanette's death. But I did want to kind of put all of that out there because I think it's important for our story. And I think it's important to why this case still hasn't been solved to this day. So like I said, Jeanette was in high school. She was just described as a normal girl. She also worked part-time at the community office of the church. And it was in this job that she had that she was helping with a church program that supported at-risk youth that were in the area. So it's obvious that Jeanette had a lot of tendencies of wanting to help others, being very caring, but she also enjoyed being a teenager. And occasionally she went to a party, she would hitchhike there, and occasionally she would smoke marijuana. But she wasn't doing anything that was harming anyone else, and she really did have a good head on her shoulders. So we're now going to get into the day that Jeanette disappeared, which was August 7th of 1972. This was a Monday, and on this particular day, Jeanette had called one of her friends who was named Gail and had told Gail that she wasn't going to be able to hang out with her that day because she had some extra chores to do. Now, Jeanette and Gail had previously made plans the day before to hang out on this particular day, but these extra chores happened about because Jeanette had a cousin named Lisa who had run away from home, and she had been gone for about a month. But for whatever reason, Jeanette's parents didn't tell her about Lisa being gone because they thought that Lisa would come back. Well, after about a month, they decided we need to tell Jeanette what's going on with Lisa. And when they told Jeanette, she was obviously upset. She was frustrated that her parents didn't tell her that Lisa had run away. And Jeanette reacted in a way that you would when your parents kept something from you that you think you should have been told. So she kind of stormed off to her room. I'm sure she probably slammed the door and stomped off as a teenager would do. So because of this, she was punished and given these extra chores. So although she and Gail had made plans, she was going to have to cancel them because she had these chores. Now, Gail later states in a 2014 interview that her and Jeanette had made plans for that day with two boys that they had met the night before at a park. And Gail said she really isn't a bully, but she just kind of told Jeanette, like, you can't leave me hanging. You're the one that kind of got me into these plans. So I really want you to come through and not cancel these plans. So it did take some convincing from Gail, but Jeanette did agree that she was going to leave the house and head to Gail's house. Now, Gail lived about 8 miles away from where Jeanette did. So of course, Jeanette decided that she was going to hitchhike. So it was around 1:20 in the afternoon. Jeanette left her house and she had told her mom that she was going to walk to the train station and take the train into Berkeley Heights. And her mom, Florence, was hesitant to let her walk the 3 miles, but decided that she was going to let her go. Now, Florence let her go under the pretense of Jeanette was going to work, and that is why she was cutting out early on her chores, and she was going to take the train to go to work. Obviously, if Florence had realized that Jeanette's plan was to hitchhike to Gail's home, she never would have let her go. So Jeanette decided, of course, to hitchhike, and she was picked up by a 19-year-old woman named Robin. Now, this gal said she typically would not pick up a hitchhiker. It wasn't something she would normally do, but she said she saw this young girl standing on the corner with her thumb out and thought to herself that if she didn't pick her up, somebody else possibly could, and she was concerned about her safety. So she pulled over and she picked Jeanette up. Jeanette got in and Robin said that they made small talk, but Robin said that Jeanette was very quiet and she was fiddling a lot with the cross necklace that she had around her neck. She could tell that there was something on her mind and that she was very nervous. She dropped her off, and unfortunately, that was the last time that Jeanette would be seen alive. Jeanette, unfortunately, never made it to Gail's home, and as the day turned into evening and the evening came and went, Jeanette never returned home. Salvatore and Florence decided that they were going to call 911 around 10 p.m. because they knew something was wrong. And of course, in true fashion, police would not take a missing persons report for another 24 hours. Now, the De Palmas did not really know if Jeanette left on her own, ran away, or was truly a missing person. And for this, the authorities were not very helpful to the family. And they unfortunately kind of had to take things into their own hands. Because even if Jeanette did disappear on her own, she was still just a young teenage girl who should not be out and about in New Jersey on her own. God knows where, doing God knows what with God knows who. Unsafe, not cool. But it does kind of make sense that her parents felt like this because she was obviously upset that her parents hadn't shared with her about her cousin running away. So in their mind, I think maybe they thought that Jeanette had done the same thing. And maybe in their mind, she was going off to search for her cousin. I don't really know. But still, I don't really think it matters from a law enforcement standpoint, because when parents come to you and say that their teenage daughter, who's only 16, is not safe in her home, in her bed at nighttime, something could possibly be wrong and every second counts. So like I said, the De Palmas decided they had to do something, but unfortunately, no attempts that were made were successful in finding out where Jeanette was. Weeks came and went with no sign of Jeanette. And then, unfortunately, on Tuesday, September 19th of 1972, a discovery was made. So there was a woman who was unpacking groceries at her apartment complex on Wilson Avenue, and she had noticed that her dog had come out of the woods, and he was carrying what she thought was a bone in his mouth. Now, she quickly realized that this was not a bone, and it was, in fact, a human forearm. She, of course, called the authorities, and an official search party was formed and conducted, as they knew there had to be more parts of this body. And since they knew that Jeanette was missing, they thought that it possibly could be her remains. One of the officers that was working with the search party found on top of a 40-foot cliff known to the locals as the Devil's Teeth, the remains of Jeanette. She was found face down. She was wearing a blue t-shirt and tan pants, and there were a pair of flip-flops lying on the ground nearby her. Her necklace was missing. They said that her face was almost gone. Her toes were gone, and animals had obviously eaten away at her remains. They were able to successfully identify the remains, like I said, as belonging to Jeanette via dental records because the body was so decomposed that this was the only way that they could identify. According to several witnesses that were at the scene, Jeanette's remains were surrounded by a series of strange and what some describe as possible occult objects. Now, there are various descriptions of these objects, but it seems that the most commonly agreed upon account of this states that her remains were found inside of a coffin-shaped perimeter of fallen branches and logs. And inside of this perimeter were several small makeshift wooden crosses. While there is a lot of back and forth and there's a lot of discrepancy with a lot of people saying this isn't true, there's people that say if she was found in a coffin-like structure, but she was found facing down, that doesn't really jive. And there's people that say she was found with sticks and shrubs surrounding her body because she was found in the woods. That's nothing satanic or cult-like or anything like that. It's really hard to differentiate between the fact here and speculation. There's a lot. There was also some Springfield residents that said that her remains were found on a pentagram, also surrounded by mutilated animal remains. However, At this point, all of that is speculation on the part of some Springfield residents and has been debunked by investigators and said not to be true. And I really don't like to talk speculation on the pod, but the reason I'm doing it is because it's very important to the story. And it has been so sensationalized and it's been brought up in every way, shape, and form. And this is one of the most infamous New Jersey cold cases. So the reason I'm bringing it up is because it's important to our story. And because Jeanette was so deeply religious, her family was so deeply religious, they think that she could have possibly been targeted because of this. So it all ties into the story. So investigators start their investigation and they perform an autopsy on Jeanette, but they could not figure out the cause of death. She didn't have any bone fractures or bullet wounds or any type of stab wounds. Her body was so badly decomposed that they had a really difficult time performing this autopsy. So for reasons unknown, the medical examiner went ahead and determined the cause of death to be strangulation. Now, there were also people involved in this investigation that said that this medical examiner wasn't necessarily qualified and competent to be conducting forensic autopsies. And there's a lot of chatter and rumor that some of the samples and tests that were conducted at that time have since been lost. And that's a big problem in this case. I think that's a big part of why this case is still unsolved. But regardless of that, for one reason or another, the medical examiner decided that strangulation was going to be the cause of death, which made it more of a suspicious death instead of what it really was, which, in my opinion, was a homicide. Investigators also went ahead and collected Jeanette's clothing. They collected her shirt, her pants, her underwear, and they also collected some soil from the scene where she was found. And they tested every single one of these items, and they were able to get some hair from a brush that was in Jeanette's dresser drawer at home. And they tested that against the hair that was found on Jeanette's body and her clothes. And they determined that there was no apparent foreign hairs that were found on Jeanette's body or on her clothes. There were some stains that were found in her underwear and also on her bra and her shirt. But unfortunately, they said that because of the decomposition, it was too hard to classify them as blood or semen. But take that for what you will. It was 1972, and I'm sure that they were very, very limited with the technology that they had. The lead investigator was named Ed Kish, also very much painted Jeanette as a bad girl and a partier, which I'm sure didn't help the investigation go in the right direction. Now, you guys know how I feel about this. I don't care if Jeanette was a bad girl, quote unquote, and a partier. I do not care what lifestyle she led. I don't think Jeanette was a bad girl. I think she was a teenager. She enjoyed a party or two, and then she worked at a church. So I don't really think that matters in the grand scheme of things. She was still horrifically murdered. And I think that that's what we need to focus on here, not what she did in her extracurricular times. So unfortunately, I do think that this did impede the investigation because the guy who was ahead of the investigation maybe didn't give it his all because he had these preconceived notions about who Jeanette was. But Jeanette was 16 years old at the end of the day, and her life mattered. So about 2 weeks after Jeanette's remains were found, there were several newspapers, including the Newark Star Ledger and the New York Daily News, that began reporting about the death, and they were reporting that Jeanette could have been a victim of an occult sacrifice. And this is all kind of during the time of the satanic panic and all of that kind of stuff. And in their eyes, this sacrifice was carried out by either a Satanist or a local coven of witches that operated inside the Watchung Reservation, which was local to the area. Even some of the local families and the church pastor kind of added to this theory as well. And everybody had a different theory about what could have happened to Jeanette and who is responsible and the different items that surrounded her body. And also, you really do have to keep in mind that this happened in 1972, and it happened in Springfield, New Jersey. And not even 10 months earlier, John List had murdered his entire family, his wife, his mom, and his children, and left them all lined up in a row in their very expensive Westfield, New Jersey home and had gone on the run. So Union County was very much reeling from that. And now they have Jeanette's death. And I think that the List family murders very much tie into some of the panic surrounding Jeanette's death, because John List was a very extreme religious human and ultimately thought that killing his family was the sacrifice that he needed to make to save their souls. And his daughter, Patty List, was very into witchcraft and had several books on it. And John was losing his mind about all of this and decided to kill his whole family. And it was a whole thing. If you don't know the John List story, I highly suggest you look it up, because it is a rabbit hole if there ever was one. So these two towns are very close together, and it all kind of coincided around the same time, just 10 months apart between John List and then Jeanette's murder. So where does the investigation go from here? So early on in the investigation, there was a homeless man who was living in the area who went by the nickname Red. And somebody had brought up a tip to the authorities about Red because he lived near the area where Jeanette was found. And they said that after Jeanette first went missing, he fled the area. So I honestly think at this point in time, they really didn't have much else other than this tip about Red. So they investigated him, questioned him, and decided that he had nothing to do with Jeanette's death. And as time went by, little information would come in from the public, and eventually Jeanette's case went cold. Now, the Springfield Police Department did at one point try to allude that Jeanette could have passed away as a result of a drug overdose, but this was debunked because there was no drugs or drug paraphernalia found on or near Jeanette's body, and she was not really known to be a drug user besides the occasional marijuana. Now, this is an interesting fact, and we're going to get into this a little more when I give like my opinion on what I think happened, or who I think is involved. But Jeanette's purse was found at the scene. However, for one reason or another, it was never entered into evidence. And I think this is a huge part of why this case isn't solved today. Allegedly, the purse was picked up by a law enforcement officer and was searched and ended up being put down. And then later, when whoever from law enforcement went back to get the purse, the purse was gone. So my question is, who the hell has the purse and where did it go? So it's very obvious that this case was not handled appropriately by the Springfield Police Department. Things were lost. And unfortunately, the focus of this case was on this very much being some type of satanic ritual or something to that effect. And I think Jeanette very much got lost in this whole thing. Other than it being about the fact that a 16-year-old girl was horrifically murdered and whoever did it got away with it, that's where the focus should have been. I'm not saying we can't talk about the fact that maybe it was a satanic sacrifice of some sort, but doesn't really matter. A 16-year-old girl lost her life in a very horrific way. Now, there's also rumors that whoever was involved was in or connected to law enforcement, and that this whole thing was a giant cover-up for what really happened. Although there isn't really any proof of that, it's still, in my opinion, worth mentioning because it wouldn't be the first time something like this had happened and it was covered up by law enforcement, a police department, anything like that. And this was a small town. Springfield, small town. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that this could have been a cover-up. And why did the purse disappear? Who has the purse? So this case goes cold. And then in 2014, two individuals named Ed Salzano and Holly Zuhl decided to start investigating this case on their own. Now, they both lived in Springfield and decided to, like I said, dig into Jeanette's case. And they actually started Justice for Jeanette DePalma. They have a Facebook group and a website. I will link both below. So during this documentary that I watched, they were asked about how they thought the satanic element came to be, how the witchcraft element came to be. And although they said they don't know exactly who first said it or when it was said and how it came to be, this is a quote: "A review of death scene photos, according to reports, is leading authorities to believe the girls' deaths may have been in nature of a sacrifice," end quote. So that was published. That was a newspaper article that was published, I believe. So Ed and Holly do believe that Jeanette was killed by teenagers that were possibly into witchcraft and Satanism, and they might have possibly been trying to pull Jeanette into it. And she, of course, being a very religious girl, was trying to sway them the other way. And she was killed for her beliefs and as a sacrifice. Ed and Holly have done their research. They know this case very well. So I do trust their opinion. And all of this speculation about the satanic aspect of this case had to have come from somewhere. They also said that after Jeanette went missing, her room was searched and she did have a booklet on demonism and Satanism. So this is interesting because Jeanette was very involved in the church. She was very religious. And there has to be something that was bothering her that day due to the way that she was acting when she was hitchhiking. She was playing with her cross necklace. There was obviously something on her mind. And it just makes you wonder what was really going on behind the scenes. Jeanette also kept a diary. And shortly before her disappearance, she had written about two boys who she had met at a party. And she wrote about how one of them was basically pouring Southern Comfort down her throat and coming on to her, which, again, is interesting. Probably not appropriate for this guy to be pouring alcohol down her throat and then trying to take advantage of her. And the gal, Robin, who picked her up that night, said that she saw, after she dropped Jeanette off, she saw Jeanette walk up to her friends, and it was two or three young guys and one girl. So although Jeanette had originally planned to hitchhike to Gail's house, that is not where she was dropped off. She was dropped off somewhere else with these people who Jeanette told Robin were her friends. So Robin didn't know any better. Of course, that's where she wanted to be dropped off. So that's where Robin dropped them off. So after Jeanette's body was found, Robin went to the police and told them and reported all of this. And none of this is written in the original report. It only talks about the girl. It doesn't mention the boys at all, which is interesting. Why doesn't it mention the boys? I have questions. Did they ever locate and talk to these people? Were these the people that took Jeanette's life? Were they the children of law enforcement officers? And that's why it was so badly handled and covered up. I have questions. We all have questions. It's all, like I said, speculation, but these are the questions we have to ask. And why isn't it in the original report if Robin went and talked to them and told them? Robin has no skin in the game. Why would she make that up? Of course she went and told them what she knew, because she is the one that technically last saw her alive, except for the people that took her life. None of it makes any sense to me. Like I said, it really doesn't matter, in my opinion, who did this, because whoever they are, whether it's one person, whether it's two, whether it's a group of people, they are evil and vile, and they need to be off the streets. Ed Kish, who is now retired, told the producers of the Hulu show that there was no basis for the witchcraft theory, and is quoted as saying that the cops are only as good as the evidence left behind. And in Jeanette's case, there was zero evidence left behind, except for the purse that mysteriously disappeared. That is me saying that, not Ed. He also said, quote, "Kids don't talk. Whoever has knowledge, if they're dead, they're taking it to their grave," end quote. This case is still very much unsolved, and Ed and Holly are still very much pushing for justice for Jeanette. Like I said, I'm going to link their Facebook and website below. And there's also a petition that I encourage you guys to sign. It's basically a petition to help encourage law enforcement to change the manner of Jeanette's death from suspicious to a homicide. because if the death is just suspicious, there's really nothing to investigate. We need to change this manner of death to a homicide. Although this case is almost 53 years old, it's still just as important as the day it happened. And it's important that whoever did this is off of the streets because they are a dangerous, dangerous human. They've probably killed since. And if it was a satanic ritual, if it was kids just messing around and taking advantage of Jeanette, we really don't know. And I think that's why this one is so important to cover, because there is so much speculation and rumors surrounding it that Jeanette has kind of gotten lost in the mix. And I don't like that. I think Jeanette's life is worth more than that. I think her legacy is worth more than that. She was obviously a very good person. She had a lot of faith. She loved her family. She loved her friends. She was making plans for her future. And she didn't deserve any of the stuff that has happened to her. And whoever did this, I hope that they sleep terrible at night and that they feel the weight of this every single day. And every time somebody reports on Jeanette's case, they get a little bit more and more uncomfortable. I am going to be posting some pictures of Jeanette on my Instagram and Facebook pages, along with the area kind of where Jeanette was found. And I do encourage you guys, if you're interested in more in-depth, to read the book, because the book was very, very interesting. There is a lot of good information in there. Again, there's a lot of speculation about the satanic stuff, and there has to be a basis for that in some way, shape, or form. I do know a lot of those rumors and a lot of the speculation was fueled by the pastor of the church that the De Palmas went to. That's a whole different can of worms. That's a whole different episode. But at the end of the day, Jeanette's life matters, and finding her killer matters, and getting it right matters. So I wanted to kind of just put it all out there, all the rumors, all the speculation, all the things we know. But my question is, where is her purse and where is her necklace? Because somebody went through her purse that day and then it disappeared. Where's the purse? That's my question. That's like the biggest thing for me, is where is the purse? And why were so many other pieces of evidence lost or mishandled? Apparently, there was some stuff that was lost in a flood that happened in New Jersey. A lot of the evidence was lost in that. I just have major questions about how some of these evidence pieces are being handled and stored and kept safe from natural disasters like floods and fires and all of that. I have questions. I feel like we should be doing better as a society at this point in time. So anyways, that is Jeanette's story. Please share this episode. Check out the Hulu documentary that I talked about, the episode I talked about. Check out the book. There is a lot of publications online about the story as well. There's a ton. It is very overwhelming. There's a whole Reddit thread, which you can get sucked into very, very easily if you want some more information and you want other people's thoughts and opinions. But that is the episode. Check out my Instagram and Facebook pages for some photos. And I will see you guys next week for a brand new unsolved case. Have a good one. Bye.
East of the Pacific, making histories of Asian American art. On view now through August 16th at the Columbus Museum of Art. Featuring more than 60 works of artists of Asian descent, the exhibition explores how migration across the Pacific has shaped American art and culture. Experience the stories, perspectives, and artistic contributions that continue to influence our world. Don't miss East of the Pacific, making histories of Asian American art, now through August 16th. Plan your visit today at columbusmuseum.org.